It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from Wisconsin's Attorney General Brad Schimmel about the Open Government Summit he's hosting this week and why he's seeking to modernize the state's open records law.
First, as Governor Walker begins his third week on the presidential campaign trail, we're getting a clearer picture of what a Walker presidency could look like. That would include big changes for at least one federal agency, the EPA.
Walker's proposal would shift most of the Environmental Protection Agency's responsibility to state-based regulators, leaving the agency to serve as an umbrella organization.
Scott Bauer joins us now. He's the Wisconsin State Government reporter for the Associated Press. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's dig into this. Now, I know this isn't a fully fleshed out policy statement here, something that Governor Walker has been saying on the campaign trail. From what he said, what would change at the EPA?
Yeah, your point is well taken. It's not very fleshed out yet from the governor. What he had said back in June at a campaign appearance and that he's repeated here recently is that he would like to see the powers that the EPA has, many of those given back to the states, leaving the EPA as this umbrella organization. What he doesn't talk about is what exactly would stay, what would go, how would the EPA enforce federal environmental laws like the Clean Water Act, and really he doesn't talk in any specificity about how this would actually work. What he does say is he mentions it in the context of this talking point of wanting to return federal power back to the states. So really it leaves us with more questions than it does answers.
And the EPA, I think he said, would still regulate interstate environmental issues if a state dumps something into a river, the river flows into the state next door. One reading of this is that would be all the EPA would do is interstate stuff. Everything else might go to the states.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be the direction Walker's heading when he talks about this kind of thing. I talked yesterday with a couple different people who have some experience and ties with the EPA. One of them, Lisa Heinzerling, who's a law professor at Georgetown and used to be a top EPA official, she basically said that approach that Walker's talking about makes no sense because you would have 50 different air quality standards, potentially 50 different scientific research arms going on, all duplicating things that the EPA does now. It really wouldn't be an efficient operation, which is one of the things the governor likes to talk a lot about, being more efficient. Another person I talked with was George Meyer, who's a well-known former DNR secretary here in Wisconsin, who actually started at the DNR prior to the EPA being created. And he talked about how, you know, in those times before you had the EPA, you had companies and businesses basically shopping around to different states looking to go where they could be the least regulated. And so you had this kind of, shopping around where now a lot of companies shop around for the best tax breaks. These companies back 45 years ago were shopping around for the weakest regulation. So he was concerned that a move like that would take us back to those times from the prior to 1970.
And as I understand from how the governor was selling this notion, one of the arguments in favor would be that people in the state would know better what their needs are when it comes to the environment and to the business community, something that maybe a federal regulator wouldn't have. Is that part of the case that's being made here?
Sure. I mean, that's part of, for the people who talk about this, that's part of their argument. It's not a new idea. You know, Republicans have been talking about this back 2011. Newt Gingrich talked about it. Other Republicans in that presidential cycle were talking about this idea. And part of the argument is that the EPA is difficult for businesses to navigate. It costs a lot of money. Projects take a lot of time to work through all the different, bureaucratic hoops they've got to go through and the different things they need to do. And so the argument is that if we move that back to the states, you'd have a more streamlined process, and it would be, you know, better for those that are looking to, the way the governor says it, have economic development while also protecting the environment at the same time.
Talking to Associated Press reporter Scott Bauer. He's reported on Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker on the campaign trail, saying he'd like to take a lot of the power currently residing with the Environmental Protection Agency, move it to the states in one form or another. Let's follow up on the politics here, Scott. You mentioned Republicans and the EPA not always going hand in hand. Is this an issue that you think might be targeted toward early primary voters?
You know, everything nowadays has to be viewed through that lens. You know, when you're running for president, as Walker is, and you need to do well early on, as Walker does, you need to think about everything that he talks about as something that, in his mind at least, he's trying to appeal to those early primary voters. The other group that he's trying to appeal to, of course, are donors and people who may look at this proposal, businessmen, and say, hey, you know, this is a guy that we can get in line with, and are, you know, we agree with that approach. And so he could, while also looking to be appealing to these early primary voters, he's also looking to appeal to people who can cut him a check.
Now, Wisconsin has been in some conflict with the EPA over the last few years. Can you talk a little bit about the history there where EPA regulators say Wisconsin hasn't kept up with what they want?
Yeah, so the EPA, there's been a long ongoing dispute with Walker's administration over air and water quality standards, saying that the EPA last year had said that it was going to impose its rules for limiting fine particle pollution in Wisconsin if the state didn't submit plans. The governor earlier this year joined with 14 other states in suing the EPA over a proposed plan to cut carbon dioxide emissions. And Walker has been very outspoken about how he felt like this plan from President Obama's administration was unworkable. So, you know, there is a history there of conflict, and the whole Gojibic taconite mine, of course, we know the history of that here, but ultimately when that company pulled out, they cited the EPA as a reason that project wasn't going to work, and the governor was critical then too. So this doesn't just come out of thin air. There is some background and some context. And again, Walker isn't the first Republican to talk about trying to dismantle in some ways the EPA, but, you know, he is talking about it again now, and he's a presidential candidate.
Do you see this being a big issue for Republican candidates in the primary, or is this something that's announced and it's just part of the rich tapestry of the politics here?
I think, you know, definitely part of the rich tapestry, and whether it becomes a premier issue or not, I guess, depends on how it resonates with voters, what kind of reception it gets, and what the feedback is when his pollsters go out in the field and tell him how it's playing.
And a bigger picture for Governor Walker, he's pointed a lot to his resume as governor here, but as a candidate for president, one has to say how they'd behave as president. We've heard him talk about foreign policy, now a federal environmental issue. Do you expect to see more fleshing out of, you know, Governor Walker making the case for what he'd do as a president in the weeks to come?
He's promised that, you know, and I think he, you know, all these candidates, there's, what, 15, 16 top-tier Republican candidates, all of them need to give some details about how they would be different from one another. And the governor, you know, his people have said that more details will be coming both about this idea and others that he's put out there. And there are so many issues that haven't been discussed and that haven't been fleshed out. Obviously, when you run for president, pretty much everything is an issue. So there will be plenty more between now and early next year when the voting starts.
Scott, thanks as always for joining us.
You bet.
That was Scott Bauer, Wisconsin State Government reporter for the Associated Press. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's recent comments on changing the Environmental Protection Agency.
Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel is hosting a day-long summit tomorrow on an issue that's of special interest to Wisconsinites these days, open government. The idea brings together a variety of stakeholders to offer suggestions to update and modernize the state's open government laws without reducing access to information.
The summit comes not long after state legislative leaders introduced, then backed away from, sweeping changes to Wisconsin's open government laws, though the summit was scheduled before all of that happened. That said, the controversy over that proposal means that any changes to open government laws will come under a lot of scrutiny from the media and the general public.
Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel is with us now to talk more about tomorrow's Open Government Summit. Attorney General Schimmel, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why are you looking to update the state's open records laws?
Well, you know, this is actually a conversation I'd had with representatives from the Newspapers Association back on the campaign trail. And, you know, I'd as DA in Waukesha County, I'd seen many occasions where there just weren't answers in our public records and open meetings laws. You know, we last revised them in 1981. And for all the young people out there, we didn't have the internet in 1981. We didn't. All of these things that now are regular uses or regular media for government, like email, even tweeting and text messaging, Skype, all those things, no one even dreamed those were going to exist yet. And so the laws don't address them. We don't know whether a town board member can appear at a meeting via Skype or not. We don't know the extent to which emails and text messages are all public records or not. We didn't have dash cameras on squad cars, much less body cameras on officers. And there are real issues to debate about to what extent those are or should be public records. And what we're doing with this summit is we're bringing everyone together. We will have people who respond to requests for records, and also members of the media, for instance, who are frequent requesters of it, and have lawyers who will help us to make sure we don't do anything that limits public access, but tries to strike that balance. You know, when a police officer wears a body camera now, if they have that running all the time, there are going to be all sorts of contacts with innocent citizens. Perhaps the officer steps into their house. I can tell you, my wife would not, you know, some days if the kids have gone kind of crazy and she didn't keep up with chasing after them all day, our house might look like a mess. And she wouldn't want a police officer's body camera showing that to the whole world. There's a real discussion to have about this. And, of course, we want to make sure we don't limit access. But
right, and before we get deeper into those issues, now this summit was planned before some leaders in the legislature and Governor Scott Walker made moves to restrict public access to records, but that makes some open records advocates nervous, given the timing. Do you have any misgivings about the timing of this summit right now?
Well, no. We've been planning this summit for months. You know, there might be a relationship in the number of people who have registered to attend, because we actually had to change the venue. We were originally going to be in one of the large rooms in the Capitol. That would have held about 150. Well, we've gone well past 150, so now we're going to be at the Concourse Hotel. There might be a relationship there that there's more interest on the issue, but I don't know that for sure. But otherwise, we're going to do the same thing we've been planning to do all along, and that's have an open discussion in this large group. We're not going to sort out any details. We'll follow this large meeting up, this summit, with some smaller meetings with many of the people who are stakeholders, with their representatives, where we can kind of hammer out and see whether there's some consensus we can reach on some recommendations to the legislature.
Now, you mentioned that the laws have not been updated since 81 and all of this new technology that's come flooding in since then. So as it stands now, how do decisions get made when a question involving some of this technology does come up?
We go to court. If there is a dispute between the person who's the source of the records and the requester, they don't agree, then we go to court. The court makes a decision, but that decision applies only to the specific facts of that case. So that leaves the rest of us. We can try to extrapolate from that and predict what it means. It's going to make a lot more sense to everyone involved if we're able to make some changes that we can all agree on. You know, for the legislature, I think they've always looked at this as a bit of a third rail. As we saw with what happened just under a month ago, if you get this wrong, it's going to cause a lot of trouble. A lot of people are going to end up being the subject of editorials in the Sunday newspaper that don't make you look good. So if we can, as a group, come up with some recommendations, we might have a shot at getting the legislature to make a few changes that can help clarify things.
Now, among the topics on the table, you've heard from some groups like the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council who'd like you to look at texting, for instance, during sessions, keeping actually making that restricted and keeping electronic records as long as paper records are kept. What do you think of those ideas?
That's certainly, both of those things are certainly important debates to have. You know, if members of a board are sitting texting each other during a meeting, well, then there's the potential that they're having a conversation that's not part of the open meeting. That's contrary to open government, and we should examine that issue. And emails right now, it's not clear just how long we have to save them. It's not clear. There are some cases that have addressed this, but again, they're narrow decisions that address the specific facts of the case. We don't have a broader picture telling us how long you have to save emails. And once you've deleted them, emails are different than a regular piece of paper that you throw in the garbage. It disappears later that night. Emails, you could still find them. Well, to what degree are our local government officials going to be responsible for going back and searching the deleted materials to find what someone's requesting? None of that is answered in our current laws.
We're talking right now with Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimel. We're talking about his Open Government Summit, which is taking place tomorrow. And in reading up on this, you've said that you understand the spirit of some of the June proposals to withhold public access to communications that involved the drafting of legislation. Do you favor an exemption in that case?
Well, I understand what some were trying to do. I wasn't privy to any of the conversations that led to what was part of the 999 bill. But I understand that there was some concern about the ability to have emails between members of an office be considered drafts. And right now the law doesn't clearly permit that. And I think there's a legitimate argument to be made that, say, the governor and his chief legal counsel going back and forth with each other over what the final document should look like, those. I think you could make a legitimate argument that that's a draft. And I have the same issue in my office. And frankly, a lot of times we'll just avoid using email. And then I'll have to go sit in my deputy attorney general's office and we'll have to talk through the issue because I don't want the early versions of what we're discussing to become a public record because, sometimes my initial reaction to things is doesn't look good. Sometimes that's why I have other attorneys on my staff to help straighten it out and say, oh, that plan doesn't work, Brad. I think there's a merit to that. And ultimately, the final document, of course, is a public record. So this is one of those discussions we should have at this summit to talk about what is a draft? Is it legitimate to make some changes to the definition of draft so that those things can be exempted?
Do you worry that in the cases of an exemption like that, that exemption could then go on to be used in broader scenarios and would ultimately perhaps end up reducing public access?
Well, it has to be drafted carefully because if you're talking about communications that come from outside groups or individuals outside your office, that's not going to – I don't think anybody's going to at this summit is going to want to see that become a draft that's exempted. But, you also just drive things – you just drive us to do things less efficiently in government because, like I said, I'm very reluctant to use email to start creating what a document's going to look like. It's clear that what I write for myself on a yellow notepad is a draft, and I don't have to share that with anybody. But that's not the most efficient way to do it. So why not consider the possibility that we just honestly let people within a particular government office share drafts back and forth until you produce what you're prepared to call a record for the public?
Now, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Governor Walker's administration has declined open records requests, citing that they are
deliberative material. Wisconsin law doesn't protect deliberative material from open records requests, but the draft proposal, the 999, would have. Do you think that the governor should fulfill those requests?
That's pending litigation right now. I wouldn't want to go venture into that.
Well, before we let you go, what is your hope for the way that Wisconsin's open records laws can be shaped by this summit going forward?
Well, there are some low-hanging fruit items that I think we can probably reach some consensus on. There are some items that are going to be stronger debates about whether now that many government agencies are redacting audiovisual materials much more frequently, whether perhaps they might be able to charge for redactions. That's going to be a big debate. I know that the two sides are pretty far apart on that, but it's a conversation worth having to see if there is some middle ground.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel. He joined us to talk about his Open Government Summit, which takes place tomorrow. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Sandra Bland's death in a Texas jail earlier this month has captured national attention, with millions watching the video of the routine traffic stop that started the chain of events, resulting in her arrest on allegations of assaulting the officer.
That video has raised questions about police handling of the encounter and more generally about police procedure, citizen cooperation with police instructions, and how police enforce that kind of compliance.
Our next guest says police departments rely too much on force and coercion to ensure cooperation from citizens, and that leads to needless tragedies. He's calling for a series of reforms to policing here in the United States. Reverend David Cooper is the former Madison police chief. He's the author of the book Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and the seven necessary steps to improve our nation's police. Reverend Cooper, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Talk about an important subject.
Well, in reaction to what happened in that Sandra Bland case, you tweeted unprofessional, disrespectful, abusive, and deadly, and later that decent police work could have prevented her death. What lessons should we be learning from what we've seen of that traffic stop?
Well, if there ever was a video that clearly would depict what a police officer in a democracy should not do, that was it. It is, as I said, it was outrageous. It seems that every few days we get another barrage and some mistakes on the part of police officers. I mean, if he wanted to irritate, get a rise out of Ms. Bland, get to the point where she was verbally challenging him, pushing and everything. That's exactly how you do it. When you disrespect people like that, that is the outcome. And, you know, I would say that he knew that because one of the dark undersides of policing is to learn from your buddies in the first years of your job how to irritate somebody to the point where you can arrest them. If you don't like somebody, you can irritate them to the point where you've got something, you can arrest them. And that's what, talk about a negative training video, that was it.
Now, when there are instances like this of things that people could look at and say, this is overly coercive behavior by an officer, one response sometimes is it's, you know, a bad officer or a few bad officers or maybe even a good officer on a bad day. You've written in the past that no, it comes from police departments, their leadership, their training. Why is that?
Well, first of all, you know, somebody has to be the adult. I mean, that's why we hire police, and that's why I so strongly argue for smart, well-trained officers who are controlled in their use of force, respectful, and who work with the community, because if they are prepared for this, if they have some sense of intelligence and some background, is you know what's going on there. And a good officer checks him or herself. Sure, that doesn't mean that words and certain gestures from people would not irritate you, you know, make you maybe more defensive than that, but the point is, you know, who's the adult in this operation, in this stop? And that's what I think that we in a democracy have a right to expect, is that our police will be unconditionally respectful to us no matter what happens.
And you've written in the past that police departments in general are too focused on officers getting compliance from citizens coercively with the use of force if necessary. How does that play out in, you know, daily policing?
Well, in daily policing, first of all, you know, 90% of or more of police encounters throughout the country on a day in and day out basis do not involve, you know, any use of physical force. Most of the force that police use is verbal, saying, this is what I want you to do, and you've got to do it now. If you don't do this, you're going to go to jail or you're going to get a ticket. But all those options should be given in a calm and directive way. And also understanding when you're dealing with people who perhaps are mentally ill, when you're dealing with people that have got a very bad historical experience with police, such as people of color have in this country, you've got to be very, very professional. You've got to be very careful the words you use and how you're doing it. There was, you know, no reason for Ms. Bland to have to go to jail whatsoever. And it sounded like at the beginning of that encounter, he was just going to give her a warning. And he could have walked away from that. He had her license number. He could have walked away and just mailed her the ticket. He would not have had to get into a physical encounter with her.
We're talking to David Cooper, former police chief here in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about policing in the United States, in part after the Sandra Bland incident that's gotten so much attention, so many views of the traffic stop video. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One response, David, is that you know, as citizens, don't we have a measure of obligation to cooperate with law enforcement officers, not put them in that position where they have to enforce the cooperation to that level?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that's the mark of good citizen and citizenship. And if we were always good, upstanding citizens, and we didn't drink, and we didn't take drugs, and we didn't have bad days, and we weren't depressed, and we didn't have episodes and bouts with mental illness, all that would be fine. But the fact is that most people do comply. But when people don't comply, the question is, how much force is a police officer going to use to get his or her will put on that person? And that's where de-escalation, that goes self-monitoring for police officers to say, uh-oh, I've had a bad day today. You know, my spouse yelled at me this morning. My kids aren't doing well in school. And now I got this. Just a second. Let's just sit down. Hey, Joe, Jane, could you come over here? I've got, you know, I need a little help. The officers team all the time. I mean, there's no reason why there could not have been a disengagement here. There was no need for it to go that way. And we've seen that time and time again. We don't know exactly what happened in Ferguson, but I will venture to say that the conversation that the officer Wilson had with Mr. Brown was probably not respectful. Just speculating here, but I would say that's a major ingredient of probably perhaps why that incident went south.
Are there police departments around the country that do a lot of training in de-escalation that you're talking about?
Well, they sure are starting to do that right now, and just about, I think the 7 or 8 large police departments in this country that are under federal court order called consent decrees are specifically as part of those decrees to take a look at their use of deadly force policies, their training towards de-escalation, their training in handling the mentally ill. Those are important a part of those consent decrees, along with diversifying the department, you know, increasing training in other areas, respecting life, maybe making strong statements that this department respects the dignity and sanctity of life, and we will do everything possible to preserve life because we're in the life-saving business. Those kind of things come out of consent decrees. Now, whether or not the leadership in the department can sustain that and that the changes then can become institutionalized is quite another thing, and that takes time.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Frank on the line in La Crosse. Frank, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I feel that the chief is definitely on the right track. I wish we had more professional people like him in the business. My concern is twofold. Actually, both aspects relate to the same idea, which is I think that many of the people who are attracted to the profession of the police, in some cases or in many cases, have issues with dominance and submission, and that they it's important to them that they, beyond just the legal or safety issues, that they must, that the people that they're interacting with must submit to them. I thought the chief pointed that out in the video, that the officer could have walked away and dealt with the situation adequately. Also, the training that officers receive to help them have the sort of self-esteem they need that they could deal with individuals without feeling either physically intimidated or the need to psychologically impose their will on people beyond the needs of the law.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. David Cooper, let's start with that first point. The people who go into law enforcement, obviously they must have a personality willing to accept that they'll be in confrontational situations, that they may be at risk. Does that come along with, as our caller said, having a fixation of some sort on dominance?
Well, it could be, and I think that's why I always have been in favor of, and did in Madison, we tended to hire older, more mature police officers and men and women who had a college degree, who had some experience in the workplace, so we had some idea about how they operated. But that's not to say that everybody who has issues is not to become a police officer, and that's why good supervision and part of that good selection processes are very important to the field. And I think that the problem necessarily is not that with the kind of people that are going into police work, but the problem is the kind of culture post 9/11 that they have inherited as they became police officers during the last 15 or so years. That the culture has tended to be more militarized. The culture has been more towards what we have kind of seen that has caused the incidents and the crisis that we now find ourselves. I think that's a direct result of sort of slipping downhill, not paying much attention to our police during these years, letting them, get more outfitted with military gear, sort of gearing up and using SWAT teams in situations where they never used them before. That those kind of things have all come together to sort of develop, as some people and the work that Bradley Balco has done, sort of a militarization and a police a warrior rather than a police guardian, a police officer who was our protector.
We're talking to former Madison Police Chief David Cooper about citizen cooperation with police officers and how police departments train their officers to interact with citizens, following in part the controversy over the arrest and death of Sandra Bland after a traffic stop in Texas.
You can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you think police are too quick to use coercion and force if citizens don't comply with their instructions, or do you think they need to do that to ensure safety? If you're in law enforcement, or if you've had an interaction with law enforcement lately, we'd like to hear about your experience. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Reverend David Cooper, former police chief of Madison. He's an advocate for police reform. He says departments rely too much on coercion and force to get people to comply with their orders. He says policies need to change.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, on the Sandra Bland case that's gotten national attention since the traffic stop video came out. Your experience maybe as a law enforcement officer yourself. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers now with David in Fond du Lac. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This really touches a nerve with me because I've been an interstate truck driver for over 40 years, and I remember what the officers used to be like 25, 30 years ago and how they are now. And the rules have changed dramatically in trucking, but these young officers that I encounter in way stations and vehicles, I get inspected quite a bit. I have probably more interaction with police across the country than anybody else. But I'll tell you something. There's something gone haywire in their training because they are cold to the bone. They'll write you up. Even if you fix a light on scene, they still write you up for that light. They're like robots. And if you even dare to question what their authority, they will come at you with guns blazing, literally, and threaten you with more fines if you don't shut up. There's something that is drastically gone wrong in police training these days, and the younger officers are worse.
David, thanks for the call. David Cooper, do you see that even in something as routine as truck inspections? Does it go that far?
Well, that's a really interesting view from a person who's had a lot of contact with police across the country. I think that that might be a fair assessment, that policing has changed today, even though crime is going down and our murder rate has been the lowest it's been in 40 years, even though the numbers of police killed in the line of duty has remained relatively the same over the years, except for two major spikes in the 1930s during Prohibition and in the 1990s when I was chief during the war on drugs. So if we look at those data, you would say, well, why are the police so uptight in many cases? What is going on with them, the training? And I think the training has got to be a major area of concern right now. How are officers being trained? Often I hear chiefs say, well, our officers are being trained according to the state standards, which to me would beg the question, well, where do the state standards come from? And what is your threshold in using deadly force? And a lot of police want to use Graham v. Connor, a Supreme Court decision in the 1980s, which said that police officers could essentially, you need to look into the mind of a police officer if he or she felt that they were in danger, that they could then reasonably, objectively use deadly force. And I think that's too low a standard. And I think we can do things to raise the standard. We're in a crisis now, and it's almost a year since Ferguson. We're going to be very close to that year point, and we really haven't heard our nation's police leaders stand up and say, whoa, okay, we're going to look at this use of deadly force. We're concerned too, because we're seeing, you know, a lot of people being shot by police. That seems to be rising slightly in the last couple of years here. Let's take a look at what's going on, and we are going to review our deadly force. We want you to know, our citizens, that we will do everything we can do to overcome our unconscious bias that many of us have living in this country towards race. We're going to control our use of force. We're going to make a commitment to the sanctity of life, and that is something that has not been part of a national conversation yet, and I think it's absolutely essential.
Talking to David Cooper, former Madison police chief, about policing the United States and his calls for reform. Back to our callers. We've got Arnold on the line in Cobb. Arnold, hi.
Yes. I was a state trooper from 66 to 1978 and left that position to become sheriff. While I was still a trooper, I remember a district attorney had me summoned and brought to his office and asked me how many times that I had stopped a car for a taillight out and then subsequently arrested the individual for disorderly conduct or resisting arrest. And I said, absolutely none. There is no reason for that situation. You will get out of the car. You've made up your mind what you're going to do. That's it. You write your whatever, and you leave. That's the way it should be.
All right, Arnold, thanks a lot for the call. So that mentality, David Cooper, has changed, you think?
Well, I think Arnold's spot on right there. It's not the way that the police have been trained in the past. There's been sort of a new shifting here right now, and I think it's a reasonable question for citizens to say, well, wait a second, we don't like this shift. We want the shift to go back the other way, and I think that's a valid question that citizens can ask of their police. We just had a national commission, a national task force on police reform, the President's 21st Century Task Force on Policing. There's some 40 recommendations. I have advocated that citizens download that off the internet and take it to their local police department and say, how is our department doing here? How are we meeting these recommendations? And where the department has met those, to say, great, we're really proud of you. Where are the areas that you need some help? Where aren't you meeting these standards, and how can we help? Because it is a collaboration. We're in a democracy, and we work together in having an effective and decent police force who will be out there upholding our constitutional rights and protecting, you know, the great values that have made this country what it is today.
Briefly, as we wrap up, that sounds like a conversation starting. Do you see that turning into the kind of reforms you're looking for anytime soon?
Well, I'm hoping. I've got, through my blog, improvingpolice.wordpress.com, I have a lot of contact around the country. Most of them are people like, I don't know, they're retired officers, and they've said, wait a second, no, how can I help? I think we need to bring this thing back. I think we need to improve police in ways that perhaps we had thought the field was going before we got retired. And there are some, there are a few operating police out there and some leaders who are saying, you know, I'm doing everything I can to move these forward and to improve my department, which I think is a continuous process of improvement.
David Cooper, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Reverend David Cooper, former Madison police chief and author of the book Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and the 7 necessary steps to improve our nation's police. Christmas might not be on your mind right now, but Waukesha's Guinness World Record for the most people singing Christmas carols was in jeopardy this week.
The town of Frankenmuth, Michigan, known for its year-round Christmas spirit, tried to break the record in a Christmas in July attempt just last Saturday. And, wait for it, they were denied.
Turns out the Frankenmuth singers only rounded up 1,300 carolers. Waukesha in 2013, their epic event, clocked in at 1,800 people. Both events involved the groups going door to door. We can only imagine what that must be like, having 1,000-plus people show up at your door on a hot July day, you know, far from Christmas.
Right. I mean, it's going to be a lot of singers, a lot of noise. They were alternately singing Joy to the World and Silent Night, just alternating between two carols, which alone could have been a little trying.
So I'm glad Waukesha held on to the title here. If anybody was going to do it, Frankenmuth, I grew up in Michigan. I went to Frankenmuth. It's kind of it bills itself as a Christmas capital. It's got a almost year-round Christmas-only store. They're open 364 days a year, except Christmas Day. Congratulations, Waukesha. Maybe you need to beat your own record, though, just to keep this one secure.
Right. We admire their spirit,
yeah,
but we're glad to keep the title here in
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.